Hi, good afternoon. My name is Daniel Webster. I'm a professor at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, where I direct our Center for Gun Policy and Research. I'm going to be moderating this afternoon's session that will focus on what's been a long time, something that we've wrestled with. It seems almost every time there is a yet again another horrific mass shooting in which there might be some hint or suggestion that a perpetrator may have been suffering from mental illness, that we begin to discuss some very difficult questions and policies. And I've been working on gun policy for over 20 years, and I've yet to publish an article on the mental health dimension to it. That qualifies me to moderate this session. But at least I had the benefit of having several colleagues here who will be presenting who do know this field inside and out. And I was also very pleased to say that back in the spring, in March, we convened the speakers for today, as well as several other experts with relevant expertise, both on mental illness and violence, as well as gun policy. And I'm very pleased at the progress that we're making to come up with recommendations for far more rational policy. So maybe we'll get into some of that as we go. But I want to just, you know, indicate that many of you are probably as frustrated as I am that we keep spinning our wheels in here, but I think we're having some good research and good thinking on a policy front moving forward. So we have four talks today, three presenters. What we're going to do is we're going to have, after each presentation, we'll take two or three questions or so, and then hopefully we'll still have some time at the end. We're kind of open it up very broadly for Q&A. And our first talk is Dr. Paul Applebaum. He's a Dollar Professor of Psychiatry at Columbia University in New York. He's going to talk to us about state laws and policies to reduce gun violence in persons with serious mental illness.
Thank you, Daniel. Hi, everybody. So I'm going to sort of set the stage for the empirical talks that follow by reviewing something of the policy framework within which we attempt to regulate the access to firearms by people with mental illness. And I have no relationships to disclose. So I will take us through a brief discussion of federal law and federal restrictions, where they come from and what they are today. And then we'll talk about some of the recent state initiatives. I'll pay some special attention to probably the most creative and intrusive of those, which is the New York SAFE Act, which I'll describe to you. And then we'll take a brief look at alternative approaches that are somewhat less intrusive and less likely to have counterproductive consequences. So, federal law. We'll talk about the early efforts at regulation, the development of the National Instant Background Check System, the NICS, and the NICS Improvement Act, which followed the Virginia Tech killings. So the prehistory of the regulation of firearms access by people with mental illness begins in 1968. During the Johnson administration, with the passage of the Omnibus Crime Control and Safe Streets Act. Those of you who were around at the time, and there are at least a sprinkling of us here in the audience today, remember that 1968 was probably not the peak experience for the United States of America. We were embedded in a war in Vietnam. The central cities were on fire that summer. There were extreme racial tensions and an enormous concern about crime. So it's no accident that that's the year that the omnibus crime control legislation moves through the Senate and the House, is signed into law by the president. That bill created several classes of people who were prohibited from accessing firearms. And among those classes of people were people who had been adjudicated as a mental defective or committed to a mental institution. Language that still exists in the law today. But there was just one problem with that statute and those restrictions. That is, there was no way to tell who fell into that or any other of the restricted categories. Federally licensed firearms dealers were instructed to provide forms to people who wanted to purchase firearms and ask them to check off whether or not they fell into any of the prohibited categories. This was something more of an IQ test than anything else. Anybody with a modicum of intelligence who actually wanted to buy a firearm simply did not check that box. Nobody ever followed up afterwards, and assuming you were not caught and convicted of a crime, in which case this could be an added charge leveled against you, you were probably home free. And that's the way it stayed for 25 years, until 1963, when the next major piece of federal legislation is passed. That's the Brady Handgun Violence Prevention Act. Many of you remember that James Brady was President Reagan's press secretary, was severely wounded in the head, shot in the head, during the assassination attempt by James Hinckley. It took years to go through rehabilitation and to come back. And he and his wife, Sarah, founded one of the most effective of the anti-dissemination of firearms organizations, and pushed for the passage, ultimately, 10 years later, in Congress, of the Brady Handgun Violence Prevention Act, which, despite its title, covered more than just handguns. The Brady Act took federal restrictions one step further, requiring the creation of a national database of excluded purchasers, which was to go online within 5 years of passage, which is to say in 1998, and mandated that the dealers check the database, not just ask people whether they were in a precluded class of purchasers. And following passage of the Act, within a few years, we finally had regulations clarifying what it meant to be adjudicated mentally defective or committed to a mental institution. As far as the latter is concerned, the federal regulations clarified that this meant committed to a mental institution by a court, board, commission, or other lawful authority, which usually, although not always, is interpreted as meaning a formal adjudication to the exclusion of a physician certification, which may precipitate an emergency commitment. But again, we had a problem. So take a look at this graph. This bar graph illustrates the numbers of people reported to the NICS for a mental illness prohibitor, that is to say, by and large, involuntary commitment by a court or other body. And by 2006, there were just under 300,000 such people whose names were in the database. However, at the time, it was estimated that there were about 2.6 million eligible mental health commitment records. So we're somewhere just over 10% of eligibles who actually made their way into the database. And then you get a spike in almost doubling of the records in 2007. What happens in 2007? Virginia Tech happens in 2007. So without any law being passed, the states, or at least several states, get on the stick and start sending more names into NICS. But the other thing that happens in the wake of Virginia Tech is the passage of the NICS Improvement Act, which provides incentives to the states of a complex sort that we won't talk about in detail for improved, indeed complete, reporting. Also, at the insistence of the NRA, requires states to implement procedures for restoration of gun rights, which not every state has done, interestingly, but which a number of states, in fact, have, including here in Massachusetts, New York, and California, a number of other states. But as you saw, even without the incentives, many states improved reporting. After Virginia Tech, This is at the end of last year. The numbers are hard to read, but I will tell you that there, at the end of last year, there were just over 8 million records in the NICS, of which the largest single group, just over 5 million, were illegal, unlawful aliens. I don't know what the difference between an illegal, unlawful alien and an illegal alien, just plain and simple, is. But there you have the FBI's classification. The reason they're the largest group, because the federal government already has their names. They're not relying on anybody to report them. But the second largest group are those adjudicated for mental health reasons as precluded purchasers. And at the end of last year, there were 1,800,000 such people. So a considerable increase in just 5 years. And then you can go down that list. The third largest group are felons, essentially 725,000 felons as of the end of last year. The group that gives me the creeps, though, is the next group. Almost 400,000 people are on the next list because they are fugitives from justice. So if you don't have a lock on the door of your house now, perhaps the idea that there are 400,000 fugitives from justice out there might give you an incentive to put one on. And then you can see the other categories. One of the ones down toward the bottom are unlawful users addicted to controlled substances, of which there are 18,000 in the NICS, which tells you nobody's making any effort whatsoever to report people who are addicted to controlled substances. They're just being ignored essentially entirely. In addition to federal law, some states have implemented their own restrictions. This example comes from Virginia, which has, given the incentive of the Virginia Tech killings, expanded its restrictive categories, not just to include people who are involuntarily admitted to a facility, but those who are committed to mandatory outpatient treatment, and those who are subject to what here is called a temporary detention order, which is essentially a physician-controlled emergency commitment. So they preclude such people from having access to guns as well. Where do we stand today? Well, state reporting to the NICS continues to be a problem, more of a problem in some states than in others. Vermont, last I knew, would not report anybody to the NICS, in part because I think it's a non-organic database, but in part, they say, because of privacy concerns. Other states, and maybe you won't be surprised at West Virginia, but you should be surprised about New York, don't report the full list of people who are involuntarily committed in their states because they don't know who's been involuntarily committed in their states. In New York, for example, adjudications are performed at the county or city level, and there is no central registry to which they are reported. And so the state of New York, which has reported tens of thousands of people to the NICS, only reports people who are committed to state facilities because they have those names. The majority of people, however, are involuntarily committed to private facilities, and nobody knows who they are, so they don't get reported to the NICS. West Virginia basically says, we're in the same situation. You pay us to do it, we'll do it. Until the money's forthcoming, forget about it. And so, in the wake of the mass killings that have galvanized so much attention and produced so much angst over the last couple of years, various states have, on their own, without waiting for the federal government to act further, tried to do something to reduce firearms access by people with mental illness. We'll talk about the New York approach in more detail in a second. Connecticut, as an example, has expanded the category of people who are excluded from firearms purchase and possession to include everybody who is voluntarily hospitalized in a psychiatric facility in that state. If you are in that category, your name will be reported to the state of Connecticut, and you will be barred for a period of 6 months from purchasing a firearm, after which, at least in principle, your name is expunged and you're no longer precluded. Some states have taken the tack of requiring themselves to abide by federal law. So Maryland passed a law saying we now have to listen to the federal reporting requirement, which was largely ignored previously. Let me talk a little bit about the New York SAFE Act, because it's much discussed and takes a somewhat different and I would suggest problematic approach. The New York SAFE Act, passed at the beginning of this year, requires mental health professionals to report people who are getting treatment from them and, quote, would be likely to engage in conduct that would result to serious harm to self or others. If you think you have such a patient in your practice, your office, on your inpatient unit, or in your emergency room, you must go to a website which is maintained by the Office of Mental Health and fill out a report which goes to your county director of community services, who screens it and then sends it on to the Division of Criminal Justice Services in Albany, where it is checked against the New York Gun License Database. If there's a match, this dangerous person has a license for a gun, the local police are notified, and that name is retained for 5 years in case the person doesn't have a gun but wants to purchase one in that period of time. The SAFE Act is probably a great example of how not to pass legislation. We have a number of good examples of that, but this is a prime one. It was drafted by the governor's office without consultation with anyone outside the governor's office, including their own Office of Mental Health. There were no legislative hearings, and it was passed within 24 hours of introduction. Now, New York has a law that says that you have to consider legislation for at least 72 hours before you can pass it, but the governor declared a legislative emergency to be able to force it through the legislature in just a day. With essentially every and no one outside of the legislature aware of what all its provisions were, and probably many people within the legislature not aware of it either. You may share my skepticism about how effective this law is likely to be in reducing gun violence. The only names in that gun license database are people who have handgun licenses. You don't need a license for a shotgun or firearm, other long gun in New York, so their names are not even included there. The response to a match with a name in the database is that the local police are notified. Law doesn't say what they do after they're notified. They could ignore the notification. They could go out to your house and take your gun away. Or if you're the chief of police's brother-in-law, you know, you probably get to keep your weapon, whereas people he likes less might not. And, of course, it addresses only a tiny part of the violence problem. As most of you probably know already, and you'll probably hear several times in the course of this session, only somewhere between 3% and 5% of the violence committed in this country is attributable to mental illness, and so we're taking a politically convenient but actually very, very small part of the problem as our focus in these approaches. Most significantly of all, at least from the perspective of a psychiatrist, I worry that this approach is likely, in fact, to be counterproductive, that the consequences of knowing that your name will be reported to the State Division of Criminal Justice Services if you say you are thinking of hurting somebody else or hurting yourself is that you will not say that. You may hurt yourself or you may hurt someone else, but you're not going to tell your treater about it in advance. Or you may just stay away from treatment altogether. It is, when you come down to it, a massive infringement of privacy for people who find themselves in need of mental health treatment. And it further strengthens that link that's evident on the front pages of our papers on a weekly basis between mental disorders and violence. I'm not going to go through the dozens of other bills that have been introduced in other states, mostly not adopted. New Jersey had an interesting proposal, not adopted, that would have required mental health evaluation of anybody who wants to purchase a firearm and a list of any household members with mental illness. Minnesota would have required a letter from a primary care physician or a mental health professional indicating that the person is not dangerous. You're not going to find many mental health professionals standing in line to write letters of that sort, I assure you. But what I want to close with here, and there were literally dozens of other pieces of legislation introduced within the last 9 months, is another way of thinking about how we might make our society somewhat safer, recognizing that as long as guns outnumber people in this country, there's a limit to how much safer we can make our society, is an approach that Indiana has adopted, and Connecticut is the only other state that has a somewhat similar, though not identical, approach. Indiana has a statute that allows the police to seize firearms without a warrant if they believe that a person is behaving dangerously, whether that person's mentally ill or not. That person has the right to a court hearing within 14 days to make a case for getting his weapon back, and the burden of proof of retaining the weapon is placed on the state. The only other state, as I said, that has a similar statute is Connecticut, and Connecticut requires a court warrant before a seizure can take place. So Indiana is a little different in that regard. These are some early data that George Parker, who's a psychiatrist in Indianapolis, published a few years ago on the Indiana statute. George says that really the county in which Indianapolis is about the only one in the state that's actually implemented the statute, and that you can see the largest group there are people who are at risk of suicide, not at risk of violence. But there are also people engaged in domestic disturbances. You know, this is the wife who says to the police when they turn up, "My husband has a gun in the dresser drawer, and he's threatened to kill me with it. Can't you do something?" And in other states, the answer often is no, there's nothing that we can do. People who are drunk or otherwise under the influence of substances, and some small percentage who are actively psychotic. Final thoughts here. Given the very small share of violence, as we said, that's actually attributable to mental disorders, it is remarkable the percentage of our effort that we spend focused on people with mental disorders when that is not likely to substantially increase our safety. There may be some benefit from tinkering around the margins here. Jeff Swanson has published some data indicating that when you implement reporting to the NICS per the federal criteria, you get some marginal gain in public safety. That is, some marginal reduction in the rate of violent crime, but it really amounts to a drop in the bucket. Moreover, when we don't think things through and we push bills through the legislature without hearings in 24 hours, we can do a lot of harm on the mental health system and on the people who are involved in pursuing mental health services, and we can make ourselves less safe rather than more. So I would close by suggesting if we're really serious about decreasing the rate of gun violence in this country, the answer almost certainly lies somewhere else than in trying to identify dangerous mentally ill people and stop them alone from getting their hands on weapons. Let me stop there.
So we have time for a couple questions.
Hand over here, yeah. Ah, so the question was, apart from mental illness, what are the other factors that predispose people towards violent behavior? I was involved in a major research study in the 90s, the MacArthur Violence Risk Assessment Study, in which we were looking at people with mental illness, but we looked at a whole range of predictors of violence, and about 130 of them turned out to be significantly but marginally associated with violence, significantly associated with violence but marginally predictive of violence, given the relatively small amount of the variance that they accounted for. So lots of things predict violence. Among the most significant are sex. Men are much more violent than women. Age, young people are much more violent than older people, and the rate of violence in our society peaks between the ages of 16 and 18, which is something to get your head around. People who consume substances are at particularly the only legal substance, namely alcohol, are at much elevated risk for violent behavior. People who have living instability, unemployment, change in residence, etc. And you know, literally, there's a list of scores of such variables, which is one reason why it's so hard to predict in advance. The needle in the haystack search is almost not the right strategy here, almost certainly not the right strategy.
One more.
So okay, one more. We'll go to this side. The question is, would these restrictions, if they'd been implemented fully at the time, have prevented any of the shootings that that occurred and galvanized so much public attention? And the answer is, for in most cases, no, because in most cases, the people involved didn't qualify under these criteria. Cho at Virginia Tech had never been hospitalized. He'd been committed on an outpatient basis, although that was never effectively implemented. But at that point, that didn't trigger NICS reporting in Virginia, hence they changed their statute afterwards. Loeffner in Tucson had never been seen as part of the mental health system. Adam Lanza in Newtown, it's not clear. The data that are public are not very informative, but it's not clear that he was ever seen as part of the mental health system either, and on and on. The people who commit these offenses when they are mentally ill are frequently people who simply haven't had contact with the care system. They're often first episode early in the course of their illness and haven't yet come to attention, which is another reason why this strategy is probably not a winning one.
Okay, thanks, Paul.